shanty where the dust hangs high, far from a river where things grow green, the flowers weep and they lean away from the blood-stained soil beneath my feet. The thorns outnumber the petals on the rose, and the darkness amplifies the sound of printer's ink on propaganda page that will rule your life and fuel my rage. Ooh,
this is an a cappella song titled As Yet Untitled. It's from Terence Trent D'Arby, but no more Terence Trent D'Arby. This was a Terence Trent D'Arby in transition. He renamed himself Sananda Maitreya. It's from his 1987 album, Introducing the Hardline, according to Terence Trent D'Arby. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and on this day, we pause and do some thinking and remembering and do some respecting as well. This is the day, this marks the day 50 years ago that the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was shot down in Memphis, Tennessee, in a small neighborhood hotel, on the balcony of the hotel, as they prepared to go to dinner in advance of an evening rally. He was on the job, as it were, in Memphis, Tennessee, on April the 4th, 1968, rallying support for some 1,300 black city sanitation workers who were 2 months into a tension-filled strike over unequal pay and poor and unsafe working conditions. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was to be the featured speaker at a church that evening, but King and a small group that came with him to Memphis would first have dinner. A courtesy car was waiting for them downstairs, and moments before he could gather himself all together to begin to prepare for the night's events, he came out of his second floor room of the Lorraine Motel, and a sniper assassin's bullet took him down. As we commemorate the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we do so with a sober reminder that his work still remains to be done, and it can be kept alive only if we make it so. Are we making it so? That's the question today. You know, we've fallen into a very bad habit, and the habit is that we remember every now and then, if we so are inclined, we remember the dead. And we also remember the dead as if they were dead. They're no more. They're done. They're finished. We have to recalibrate our thinking, it seems to me, because only their bodies are dead. Their physical bodies are gone. But in the situation, as we consider Dr. Martin Luther King, we have a body of work, a major body of work accomplished by the time he was 39 years old. By the time he was 39, he had transformed the world. He had brought the world back to its senses, and he had instructed us all about what is important. And what is important is a collective struggle for justice, for freedom, for the right to life itself, the right to occupy space, intellectual space, physical space, political space, economic space, and the right to defend our collective dignity. At this point in his life, he was famous in making a speech that he was famous for saying he was not fearful. He knew very well what he was up against. And yet he kept going on. And as he grew and matured into this vision that he had, and therefore this mission that he knew he had to accomplish, and he also knew it would not end with him, but he was one of the conduits, a very important conduit in this struggle, which was a lifelong struggle. But he prepared himself to take on this struggle. This was one of the things we see in common. We had a discussion yesterday about Winnie Mandela, where people have a vision and they may not be perfect in themselves, but they're perfect as we can expect with respect to their vision. Let's listen to evidence of that. This is a short enough clip of Dr. King talking about that vision and giving us a clue of his political understanding and his maturity and his commitment to moving forward despite what he already recognized were threats to him, to his family, to his people, but still, he gives us instruction. Let's listen to Dr. King now.
One day after finishing school, I was called to a little church down in Montgomery, Alabama. And I started preaching there. Things were going well in that church. It was a marvelous experience. But one day, a year later, a lady by the name of Rosa Parks decided that she wasn't going to take it any longer. She stayed on a bus seat. And you may not remember it because it's way back now, several years, but it was the beginning of a movement where 50,000 black men and women refused absolutely to ride the city buses, and we walked together for 381 days.
Yes, sir.
That's what we got to learn in the North. The Negroes have to learn to stick together. We stuck together. We sent out the call. No Negro rode the buses. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life. And the people of Montgomery asked me to serve as the spokesman. And as the president of the new organization, the Montgomery Improvement Association, that came into being to lead the boycott, I couldn't say no. And then we started our struggle together. Things were going well for the first few days, but then about 10 or 15 days later, after the white people in Montgomery knew that we meant business, they started doing some nasty things. They started making nasty telephone calls, and it came to the point that some days more than 40 telephone calls would come in, threatening my life, the life of my family, the life of my children. I took it for a while in a strong manner, but I never will forget one night very late. It was around midnight. And you can have some strange experiences at midnight. I had been out meeting with the steering committee all that night. And I came home. My wife was in the bed, and I immediately crawled into bed to get some rest, to get up early the next morning to try to keep things going. And immediately, the telephone started ringing, and I picked it up. On the other end was an ugly voice. That voice said to me in substance, "Nigger, we are tired of you and your mess now. And if you aren't out of this town in 3 days, we're going to blow your brains out and blow up your house." I'd heard these things before, but for some reason, that night it got to me. I turned over and I tried to go to sleep, but I couldn't sleep. I was frustrated, bewildered. And then I got up and went back to the kitchen, and I started warming some coffee, thinking that coffee would give me a little relief. And then I started thinking about many things. I pulled back on the theology and philosophy that I had just studied in the universities, trying to give philosophical and theological reasons for the existence and the reality of sin and evil. But the answer didn't quite come there. I sat there and thought about a beautiful little daughter who had just been born about a month earlier. We have 4 children now, but we only had 1 then. She was the darling of my life. I'd come in night after night and see that little gentle smile. And I sat at that table thinking about that little girl and thinking about the fact that she could be taken away from any minute. And I started thinking about a dedicated, devoted, and loyal wife who was over there asleep. She could be taken from me, I could be taken from her. And I got to the point that I couldn't take it any longer. I was weak. And something said to me, "You can't call on Daddy now. He's up in Atlanta, 175 miles away. You can't even call on Mama now. You got to call on that something and that person that your daddy used to tell you about." That power that can make a way out of no way. And I discovered then that religion had to become real to me, and I had to know God for myself. And I bowed down over that cup of coffee. I never will forget it. Oh, yes, I prayed a prayer, and I prayed out loud that night. I said, Lord, I'm down here trying to do what's right. I think I'm right. I think the cause that we represent is right. But, Lord, I must confess that I'm weak now, I'm faltering, I'm losing my courage. Seemed at that moment that I could hear an inner voice saying to me, Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Stand up for truth. And Lord, I will be with you even until the end of the world. I tell you, I've seen the lightning flash. I've heard the thunder roll. I've felt sin breakers dashing, trying to conquer my soul. But I heard the voice of Jesus saying, still to fight on. He promised never to leave me, never to leave me alone. No, never alone. No, never alone. Promise never to leave me. Never to leave me alone. Sometimes I feel discouraged. And I don't mind telling you this morning that sometimes I feel discouraged. I felt discouraged in Chicago. As I moved through Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama, I feel discouraged. Living every day under the threat of death, I feel discouraged sometimes. Living every day under extensive criticisms, even from Negroes, I feel discouraged sometimes. Yes, sometimes I feel discouraged and feel my works in vain. But then the Holy Spirit revives my soul again. There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. God bless you.
A very powerful sermon. But in that short clip that we heard, we also heard a man who also, even though he felt he just could not make this, could not take on this burden, he was compelled to do it. That was the vision. And it involved him accepting. He already had accepted that he was a marked man. And still his faith kept him rooted and grounded in the work that he knew he had to do before his time was up. So he was not afraid. He was very clear that, if you will, ordained by a power. He was chosen, he felt. But he was a weak man, he said, compared to the enormity of the task before him. He doubted, he questioned whether he had the wherewithal to proceed with this task. And so, we heard him in the speech concede that even though he was flawed as a human being, even though he doubted, even though he hesitated, even though he questioned, he was absolutely sure that he was on the right path. He also was sure that he was a marked man. This is a unique kind of courage. But the interesting thing, especially in the African American community, we have seen this kind of courage time and again, where people look at the enormity of the task, they are divinely selected to undertake. They come to a point where they question, why me? They come to a point of reconciling that the enormity of the task far outweighs what they consider the ability to do it. But then they come to a point of reckoning. And in reckoning, it is the task that gives them the divinity, the power, the strength, the vision to do it. We have so many examples. We have Harriet Tubman, just to pick a few. We have Marcus Garvey. We have Elijah Muhammad. We have Adam Clayton Powell Jr., a flawed man, no question about it, but brave and clear about what he needed to do, why he was in the position he was in to do it. We have Malcolm X. We have Rosa Parks. We have any number of individuals who by any other measure would be, well, they were ordinary people with an extraordinary task to achieve. They felt totally outmatched. They certainly felt the hatred, the intent of the world that they were opposing, the threats. And they knew that their safety, that their very lives would be on the line for the work that they were going to do. And yet they did it. They submitted to the power of the mandate. Because at that time, in that place, at that hour, they were the best ones to do, to tackle the job and get it done. So the instruction that we just received from Martin Luther King is, we humans. But every now and then, if we take inventory, we will recognize the superhuman aspect in all of us. The question is, are we willing to embrace it? Are we willing to accept the burden, knowing that the very task would be at the risk of our lives? And yet look within our history. and we see how effortlessly, in a sense, there's a period in which there's great questioning. Why me? Can I do this? Am I supposed to be doing this? Do I have what it takes to get this thing done? It's just me, my own people are ganging up against me. Can I take this on? And if I do, can I bring this task to fruition? I now accept the task. And I accept also the enormous price I will have to pay for undertaking it. That is what we should recall about Martin Luther King Jr. He was quite aware. He even predicted his own death. But still, he persevered. Not for himself, but for all of us. We too have a mandate, except we find all kinds of reasons not to accept it, not to want it. It's too hard. It's too dangerous. And I don't want to take on an infinite task with my finite self. We have all kinds of reasons for begging out. And yet, we have a long and illustrious history before us of people who put themselves into real service, even at the expense of their lives. We'll take a break now and come back to hear how you reconcile this enormous challenge right after this at 888-874-4888.
Haven't stood like a man for such a long time now. I called on my God, but he was sleeping on that day. I guess I'll just have to depend on me. Shall I tell my children if they ask of me? Did I surrender forth my right to be? You see, my daddy died to leave this haunting ground, and this same ground still haunts me.
You're listening to Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're talking today about aspects that we seldom ponder, certainly not collectively, when we talk about our, quote, heroes in the civil rights movement, our heroes in the task and process of humanizing the society and the price they paid, the price Martin Luther King Jr. paid 50 years ago today was assassination by a sniper's bullet. And as we are exploring, he knew this was a very real possibility. He had received enough threats. He had received enough warnings of what would happen, and yet he persevered, and yet he fulfilled his task. Do we have the same courage to do it? 888-874-4888 is the number to call. And I want to know what you're thinking on this day about this particular question. Is there anything you believe that you were put on the planet to do, no matter what? That you were selected by a divine hand to do it. It may look like an ordinary task, but it isn't. To bring peace and calm to your neighborhood, to your community, to your nation, to work at smoothing all these rough edges, to bring people together who don't want to be together, who have no history of being together. And in so doing, you create power, real, palpable power. Maat from New York, you start us off today.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me, Eutrice?
Yes. Yes, I can.
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes this Chinese cord pulls out. Yeah. It really is an excellent question. And I think one of my thoughts is that I think we also need to look at the real, what really happened. So it does go beyond a lone wolf sniper. And I'm referencing all the work that, I can't think of his first name right now, but the last name is Pepper.
Claude
an attorney.
Pepper.
Excuse me?
You're talking about Claude Pepper?
I don't think it's Claude. He's the attorney that came together with Mrs. King, the family, and there was an actual...
Yes, I know who you're talking about. He was also the person who took a lot of information from Earl Caldwell. I happen to know that for a fact.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay,
Earl
because
Caldwell
there was a
the
trial.
Only reporter on the scene. He was at the time working for the New York Times. He was the only reporter there. And his room was directly under Martin Luther King's room. He was included in many of the activities and discussions, private discussions. And he happens also to be a good friend of mine.
Earl, yeah, he was on the air at the, I guess you could say, the sister station with Michael G. yesterday, and I understand he's working on a book on, I guess the overall experience. But I think that the attorney Pepper brings out some important information. Not a whole lot of people knew about. I guess it was like a civil type trial. I'm sort of fuzzy on some of the details, but the bottom line is he actually brought out the conspiracy of the assassination and who some of the prime and government connected, I guess FBI connected, bad actors in all of it. And one of the stories that he told was that Dr. King's life could have possibly been saved. Have you heard what a nurse revealed at the hospital? Did you hear that story?
Here's where I am. The most important thing to me in the scheme of things, and I agree with you, at some point we have to know what the truth is in its finite sense. We have to know the truth. It would be good to know the truth. But what I just shared was the more important thing. He knew he was a marked man. So the inevitability of his assassination was something he himself foretold. This is, and why we are acting like this is a, my God, look what happened. He knew that. He knew it was going to happen.
Mm.
And you look at Malcolm X. Malcolm X absolutely knew he was a marked man and that he was going to be assassinated. You know, you look at the people, they tell you. They tell you what is going to happen because they know. And then we act all surprised when it does happen. The more important thing for us, I think, we shouldn't dismiss the need for an accounting as we can get it, but we have to concentrate more on what it is they themselves identified as the important thing about them. The manner of death, how it's going to come. They were at peace with that. They understood it. They accepted it. And still, they put themselves and their lives in service of us. That is the more important thing, it seems to me, to really understand.
Indeed. And I think one of the things that we can really move into the future on is those first of all, his anti-war, his peace stance, that's just so outstanding and so relevant. And those three, I forget how you referred to them, but poverty, racism, and militarism. He just gave us a blueprint.
The three pillars, the three evils of our society.
Absolutely.
We consistently ignore the instruction we get from every single one of our leaders, including those who have been assassinated. Not one of them rejected the notion that they'll be assassinated. They knew. They all knew. The question is, do we value that? That in the face of that ultimate price, they nonetheless continued to do their work, completely understanding that this was the nature of the work. It would involve them dying by violent means. This is what we just heard. We heard a young man in the prime of his life, just getting out of theological seminary and faced with a dilemma, a crisis. Any other sane individual would run like hell away from a thing called leadership at that time. But what did he say? He knew he was marked for death. And he reconciled in his own mind that if that is the price you pay for the work I am divinely chosen to do, I will have to do it. He talked about who wants to leave this gorgeous little baby girl? Who wants to deal with the fact that his wife would have to do without him, and he without her? We miss the profundity of that sermon that he shared. He is saying, I envision all these things. I have already experienced the prelude to it. When he said, I've been to the mountaintop, I may not get there with you. What was that? Except a prediction, a realization of what will happen, and a conviction that he will still go ahead. We don't see that every day. And we miss the enormity of that instruction every time. So we should not spend the rest of our lives trying to figure out who killed them. We know who killed them. We may not know the names of the persons. We may not know you know, the fine details, but we know. We know who killed him. A system that he was fighting killed him. And let the people go on who can, who are in a position to go on. I've myself been encouraging Earl Caldwell for years to write a book. He was the only eyewitness there and from the media. He was given a special privilege to be in the presence of the inner circle. He saw what happened. He was never interviewed. And there were people he thought would have been interviewed who were not interviewed. For all these years, at least 20 years, I've been asking and encouraging him to write a book. But maybe the time just isn't right. Maybe he's ready now. But for me...
Yes, I think it's coming.
Well, I hope so. For me, the most important thing to spend my time with is understanding the instruction here. And the instruction is coming from none other than Martin Luther King Jr. himself. What we ought to be doing and why he paid the price, knowingly paid the price. This is an extraordinary thing. Thanks for getting us started today. Gwen from New York, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi, Therese. It's Gwen.
Hi, Gwen. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I just wanted to thank you for, I love the speech. I love Martin Luther King. And I want to thank you for putting it on because it was beautiful. And I just have to say my own feeling about Martin Luther King is he's very Christ-like to me. And I think that what happened, you know, it was almost like predestined to happen. He sacrificed his life for the good of all the other people that received the benefit. And I think he's still inspirational today. And I mean, who can put into words how magnificent this man was? But he was definitely not just he was not an average leader. He wasn't a regular person. This man had something very, very special about him, this incredible ability. And I love the humanity of him talking about the fact that he knew. I mean, he knew they were going to kill him. And he gave this speech, and it was so raw, and it was so candid and beautiful. And he's not here, but I think we all learned something from Martin Luther King. We all learned a lot. He made tremendous changes. And, you know, I remember when I was little, my mom used to have his picture hanging up down where my mother had a big board of all the people that she loved. And she was pretty involved in, very involved in Black justice in Philadelphia. And there, you know, his picture was there, and she had all the fallen people that were there on her board. And, you know, he seeps into everybody's life. And I think the question you asked is, do you feel like you have a calling? And I just want to say that a long, long time ago, when I was a little kid, maybe in junior high, that I got this kind of message or feeling that even if the ship is going down, you have an obligation to fight as hard as you can to prevent the ship from sinking, even if you know in the end it's going to be a loss. And I think the ship that is sinking now and was sinking then was very much, I see a lot of sinking ships. So one of the big things was our environment, that we've just trashed everything in our site. We've destroyed it. And I just don't think that we're supposed to be doing that. I don't think that's not what we're on this planet to do. And so that was one of the shifts. And I guess always to speak up when you see something wrong. And so I do. I get myself in trouble, but I do. If I can do something, I will put myself out there to help somebody else who might not be getting, you know, I'll chime in and I'll help. But that's kind of, I mean, I'm certainly not being called like Martin Luther King, but I feel like as a foot soldier in the human race, I have a job. I have an obligation here. This is not a free ride. You don't get to live on the planet and just turn it into garbage and kill people. I mean, that's not why you got given your life. And you are supposed to do the heavy lifting. So I believe it's my job and it's everybody's job to get out there and work to make sure our planet it gets to be a better place and we keep it nice. I don't know.
Thank you for contributing today. Thank you very much, Gwen, for your call. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Eutrice.
Hello.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I'm getting some takeaway messages here from what's been going on. And one of the most important messages for everybody, I believe, to understand is there's always a price for any person to be injured. They allow to kill you literally or in other ways kill you, you know, figuratively or employment or in any way they can when you want to change the status quo. And Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and people of that type are well known. But when you want to change a system that is run by the rulers and do something different, they'll try to kill you in one way or the other. Like, you know, if you look at my book, Playing a Game, you'll find out they had a way of dealing with me because I didn't go along with the system. I wouldn't say yes, sir, to white people just because they're white people. I wanted to swim in a swimming pool where white people swam. And I wanted to sit in the theater in the front just like anyone else would be able to do. So they had a way of sort of killing me by getting rid of me. That's what they did with me. They didn't shoot me or kill me physically, but they thought they had me by what they did in the process of getting rid of me at that time in the 50s in Georgia. So I think that is important to understand that if you're going to do anything really progressive and getting ahead, there's always someone that's going to be gunning for you. Also, I think the takeaway message from Martin Luther King is that you have to take some steps. It may be in your neighborhood. You may be a person who, when everyone says no and they don't like trees, you get all the trees put in into your neighborhood, even though other people don't like it. You get creative. It may be other things that people don't go along with, and you do it in spite of them. And, for example, my students, those who were not really interested in training them, well, I took the risk of going to Woodshed with them. And what happened is that, many of the white people would call me a racist person because I wanted them to hire some black instructors from the neighborhood. So, you know, there's always a price to pay if you step out there, and it can be death in one way or some other way of killing you when they can. And that is what I have lived through, and I have family members who took a position, and they have suffered. Some have tried to kill them, maybe not physically, but employment-wise and whatnot, because they took a stand. So, in other words, anybody all over the world who is against the status quo, like, for example, American foreign policy. Any country where any kind of leadership is against American imperialism and for the good of the people in the country to have the resources in their favor, like Salvador Allende in Chile, they're going to get rid of anyway. So that's one of the things that is important to understand, anyone who takes a leadership position.
Thank you. And I wholeheartedly agree. Absolutely. Gino from the Bronx, you're on the air, and you're a little tight on time.
Okay, Eutrice, I'm off and running. Good day. Good day. The name of that author of the... I know Claude Pepper was a congressperson in there. This is William F. Pepper. He was a former attorney for the King family.
Right.
And
okay.
The book is The Plot to Kill King. Now, William, he's a human rights lawyer, most known for his defense of James Earl Ray in the trial for the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. and of Sirhan Sirhan in the trial of the murder of Senator Robert Kennedy. Pepper's the author of An Active State and Orders to Kill, and he has been active in government cases, including the 9/11 Truth Movement, and attempts to charge George W. Bush with war crimes. Now, the former book was endorsed by Coretta Scott. She said, "We recommend this book to everyone who seeks the truth about Dr. King's assassination." Now, what Matt was relating to, I've heard in the past, Earl Caldwell's talks when he was there, and they removed the area where, you know, the shooters were hiding and all that and so on, and evidence at the scene. But Pepper, Dr. Pepper, he talked about that Dr. King was still alive. I heard him on Gary's show about a year ago. He was still alive, and the nurse was told to get out the room, and they said an expletive, and they spit on him, and he was still alive, and they put a pillow over his face. So now the more important thing I would say, although that's the tragedy of it all, I got to speak on divinity real quick, just to show you, because most of us are afraid of our mortal nature for it to end, but the power of the spirit, it's like the firefighters going into those buildings or people putting their life at risk to save somebody. There's a point where it transcends human fear factor, and we do touch the divine part you were referring to earlier. And Martin, even though his father was a preacher, his grandfather, he was frightened. He was doing the right thing, but he was afraid. They threatened him and so on. By the way, I'm glad he didn't sneeze when he got stabbed by that deranged woman. And he the power of the spirit came on him, and he went walking for that next 11 years, despite all attempts to bribe him, and he could have lived to be a long life, see his daughter grow up. So there's a testimony of the power of really the Holy Spirit, I got to say. And just to leave off, we're in the part of the story that doesn't get the most notice. We see the birth of that particular soul, Jesus. We see the death and resurrection, overcoming death, first time in human history, from what I understand. Physically, even Thomas had to put his hands on him. But the next part, when those disciples ran away, which relates to what you're speaking of to all of us, they all ran away in fear. The Spirit came on them 50 days later, and they were used to help to change that world. So that's the most important key out of it all, I believe. And just to leave off, I believe Martin is in such a joyous state with what he did to lay his life down, to cause us to have better race relationships and really grow spiritually, living the Christian talk, not just talking it like a parrot. He's a model for all of us, and he's a question mark to all of our consciences for the rest of our lives. I do believe that, whether it be people in high power or regular folks like us, he is a benchmark. He is used as a goal, a shining star, so to speak, what direction we move in. Like the former speaker was saying, David, we go slowly. Nobody has to do the big thing like he did, but a flower grows slowly. We don't go to heaven. We grow to heaven. Every little step that seems little is important to get to the heights. Sometimes something happens where we may have one of those moments where we have a quantum leap. But don't get scared with that. Do the little steps. So I just leave off on the part of we're in Pentecost, as they say it. The story's not over. And it includes us. He resurrected. What about us?
Good thought.
Okay, Trees, good to know you're still there.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your call and your contribution. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it gives us a hint that we ought to be reevaluating our lives and our reality in this way. We're still searching for answers. We don't have all the answers, or we don't have most of the answers that we really need, but we should continue the search for answers. Wherever it is that we can start, go ahead and start. And let's also honor those who, at great sacrifice, brought us along the way. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Global Alert News. I hope you keep it right here, and tomorrow we connect again. Bye-bye.
Out by a shanty where the dust hangs high, far from a river where things grow green, the flowers weep and they lean away from the blood-stained soil beneath my feet.